Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with Dr. Kiki Sanford for Monday, April 19th, 2010, a whale of a tale. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Audible.com. For your free audiobook download, go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. Welcome, everybody. This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. That's right, 1 hour with one topic with one expert. And we're going to get down and dirty. Well, maybe it's kind of clean because we're dealing with the watery oceans and whales. We're going to be talking with Dr. Are you a doctor yet?
Not yet.
On your way to being a doctor. with Deborah Giles, otherwise known as Giles. And she is an expert in whale behavior and in biogeography. She also uses GIS to predict areas of importance for threatened species, habitat conservation, ecosystem restoration, and works in the Biotelemetry Laboratory at UC Davis. And you have 20 years of experience observing whales in the wild in Puget Sound. Thanks for coming. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
You're welcome. So what got you interested in whales to begin with? What was the deciding factor?
So apparently when I was quite young, maybe about 8 or so, I mentioned to my folks that I had had a dream about a black and white whale and that I had been able to kind of change places with it, shape shift with it. And
transmogrification.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't remember ever having seen whales, certainly not in captivity or in the wild, having grown up in Sacramento and being landlocked, maybe in a book. So that's kind of where I think I probably first saw them. Mm-hmm. That's my first memory of them specifically. And then ever since then, I just have loved them and read as much as I can. And so I guess about my 17th birthday, turning 18, I was taken with some friends up to the San Juans. A good friend knew I wanted to see them, and she kind of did some research, where can we see them from reasonably distanced from Sacramento. And so we planned a road trip, and I spent my 18th birthday watching the southern resident killer whales on San Juan Island in Washington State. So that was my first real amazing experience with them that is very, very vivid in my mind.
Right. One of those formative experiences.
For sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So since then, I've made the trip up there one time it was every other year, and then maybe every third year. So just visiting for holidays and vacations, summer vacations. And so when I graduated from high school, I thought, I'll just get a job and work for till September when school starts, and then get into school and start my education so that I can figure out how to help these, work with these whales.
Yeah.
And 11 years passed by. So
blink of an eye before you know.
Really, truly. Yeah. It was working at a land survey equipment company, which in a way really benefited my future work because I was learned a lot about the survey equipment that I would eventually use to help my study with the southern residents. So my partner Jim and I had gone up in 2000, and after leaving that time, he kind of just said, are you going to do this thing, quit your job and go to school or what?
Yeah.
And so I did. And in 2001, I started my undergrad education because I hadn't been back to school after high school.
Oh, wow.
So it's been a long haul. I've been in school.
How was constantly. That to go, have a break and then go back as an undergrad as an adult?
Uh-huh. Well, I don't have any experience to juxtapose it to as a young person. I think talking with my students now, I'm really glad that I waited. Mm-hmm. For me, it was the right time. Although I was driven at the time, I was so much more driven and knowing exactly what I wanted to do. However, that changed, actually. I went in as an undergrad in philosophy because I thought I wanted to do environmental law. So I thought I'd get a law degree. And I did two amazing internships with an animal advocacy group that does a lot of legislative work in Sacramento. And after spending two quarters as an intern, I loved the job and learned so much. But I definitely realized that I wanted to be more out in the wild, and studying them in the wild instead of trying to help them in from the
political angle. Yeah.
Right.
How is it to think of it? I mean, as a scientist, you want to get your hands on. Do you get your hands on with the way? I mean, are you looking at them from a distance? Mm-hmm. How do you study them now that you've gotten into working with them?
Right. So my going back to what I was saying about my experience in the survey industry. One of the things that was really exciting at that time, kind of being in the industry at a particular time, and your previous gentleman was talking about this. So GPS, when that first came out, I was working at the survey equipment store, and it was a military device. We didn't have personal GPS units. Mm-hmm. It was one of the first GPS units that a person could buy was in the, say, $900 range, and the accuracy was fairly ridiculous. You would have periods of time where you could actually get your location on the planet, but generally it was a scrambled signal. And over time, fairly quickly, actually, they went from being that expensive to something where you could hold, you know, have one as a personal user, a hiker or something. So
and now they're in our cell phones.
Exactly. And in our dogs.
Yeah.
So that equipment, kind of being in it, growing up with the GPS as it was kind of becoming more accessible. It was always in the back of my head that I could use that technology to do research from a distance on whales that were potentially being impacted by the presence of humans in their environment.
Right.
And so I didn't wait, but when I left the survey world, it was a perfect time to leave it because the technology was such that you could couple, say my equipment uses a GPS unit, a very, very high grade, survey grade GPS unit.
Mm-hmm.
So sub-meter accuracy after differentially correcting, a laser rangefinder and a compass so that I can take offset data points like to you, although this is a bit too close, but say to a whale and a boat and get the distance between those two things.
Triangulation, basically.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Yeah.
But it's all internal, so there's no math involved and no human error as far as doing those math equations to get distance, because people have certainly been using that same idea with individual instrumentation for a long time, doing animal research and killer whale research. Anyway, the equipment is such that it allows me to take offset data points and behavior data on the whales from, generally, my distance was right around 350 or 400 meters.
What kind of, so with behavioral data, are you talking about just the movements that they're making, how deep they're going, how long they're underwater, or what kind of behavioral stuff?
So I did pilot my study on a NOAA, a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration study. A woman named Dr. Dawn Noren was doing a study on the energetics of killer whales, and she was timing their dive times. I don't do that because somebody else was already doing that. So specifically what I was looking at, my question, one of my four or five questions for my dissertation, I'm looking at killer whale group cohesion, and I'm trying to determine whether or not group cohesion is changed by the presence of vessels, the distance that vessels are, the activity that vessels may be engaging in. So are they powering up? Are they just sitting there? Are they motoring along with the whales?
So
it's multivariate sort of variables that I'm looking at to try and look at cohesion.
And by cohesion, you mean the group just staying together and not splitting up and going running off in separate directions.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So one of the things that we can look at when we're looking at a group of whales, we can look at directionality. So are they from breath to breath to breath, are they generally going in the same direction?
Mm-hmm.
We can look at cohesion. So are they in contact with one another? Are they tight or loose or spread? And those are differentiated by body lengths, essentially.
And are they considered a pod if they are just a social group? Or do they have to be in a cohesive group, right, like where they are within a certain distance from each other?
So pod refers to their more their genetic makeup.
Okay.
It has to do with them being closely related to other whales. So you are in a pod if you are closely related to other animals, then you're all in a pod. So I guess I should, before I get into like the behavior, go back and tell a little bit just about killer whales in general. So people, I think right now, unfortunately, because of the terrible accident in Florida, know a lot more about whales than they did even in January of this year. So it's, I think in that regard, that it's great that people are learning more about these whales.
And so, I'll just stop for a second for maybe people who haven't heard about, or just to jog people's memory. In February of this year, a trainer was drowned by a whale at SeaWorld. And I'm don't recall the name of the whale. It was Tillicook or something.
Tillicum.
A very large male killer whale who has a history of killing people. There was another trainer that with two other whales, another trainer was killed with Tillicum in the presence. And then there's a questionable case where somebody snuck into Tillicum's pool and then he was found drowned. The interesting the question here is whether or not it's horseplay, as they call it, or if this was an aggressive act, or what the whale is doing. But that's what we may get into later on in this conversation. But to begin with, this is a subject that has brought up a lot of interest recently as a result of this terrible accident.
Right. So killer whales, generally speaking, there are three forms of killer whales in the world that you can say maybe an ecotype, or I think ecotype or ecoform is a good way to think about it. We actually might have more, but as far as the literature is concerned right now, certainly there are three different types. And what I mean by types, they can be distinguished by their morphology, so what their body looks like, what they eat. So are they a fish eater, or are they a mammal eater, or are they maybe a combination?
A generalist.
We can actually differentiate them by culture, and that's a whole interesting hour-long topic in itself, and maybe we can get back
to whale. Yeah, whale culture. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating.
And location. So, and DNA. So. Okay. With regard to the ones that I study, we know that there are, so you were asking me about pods. There are three pods within the clan that is considered the southern resident killer whale group, which are a group of, right now, 89 whales, although some of those we can't really count yet. Mm-hmm. We had five births in this past couple of months, but they really can't be counted in the census until they've made it a full year.
Right.
But let's say we have 89 right now. So those animals were listed in 2005 as an endangered species under the Endangered Species Act because their populations were so small.
And so this southern resident population, they are considered a distinct species or is it just a population that's considered endangered?
So it's a unique situation, and I think we'll see more and more of that as people are starting to really do a lot of intensive research. The southern residents are by far the most studied group of killer whales in the world, although other groups are close behind.
Yeah, I'm sure it makes it the fact that they're resident, that they stay in one place.
Well, that's a misnomer.
Is it?
And
okay.
So we'll get into that too in a sec.
There are all these.
I know.
These
I
things
know.
You think you know, and then you don't.
Exactly. Great. So I think it has to do with the fact that in the late 70s, when there were a lot of captures from this population in particular, the residents of in Canada, around where these whales are frequent in the summertime, and also Washington State residents were really, really up in arms with the number of animals that were taken out of this population. And finally, sorry, I kind of lost my train of thought there. There's so many different components to this whole messy thing that we have going on. But essentially, there's the Southern residents were determined to be, at that time, very, very unique to, say, the other closest whales physically, geographically, that are in the area, which are mammal eaters. And it was obvious by that time, say the 76, when the last whale was taken, that these whales, the Southern residents, never came into contact physically. They didn't mingle with the mammal eaters, which were in a boat. You can sometimes see mammal eaters, quote, transients, which, again, misnomer, and the Southern residents, you could, on a boat, you could maybe see them within, you know, the same day. Certainly they're within the same water and in overlapping territory, but never mixing. And so that was interesting, because in a lot of ways we think globally that this is one species.
Yeah.
What we're finding now, after their listing, in 2005, the federal government called for research to be done, and research that had already been done came to really much more notoriety. Some of the genetics information that Dr. Hosel had come up with, and other folks, and then these cultural things, and then also just the like this guide I brought to show you.
Yeah, you can just push it, put it right there. Pull it up a bit. Yeah.
So this is a census that Ken Balcom, also a UC Davis alum, has been putting together since the mid-70s. And what he's been doing is every whale that is cataloged is, or every whale that's seen is in that catalog. And because Ken has been researching these whales for so long, he's been able to put these matrilines together. So
it looks as though, are they determined here based on their fins and the markings?
That's how we identify them in the field. They're in that book based on who their mother is.
Okay.
Or who their oldest living female relative is. Wow. So the population was determined after... actually, the Center for Biological Diversity sued the federal government to try and have them listed as a threatened subpopulation. Mm-hmm. And after all of this research came in 2005, the federal government surprised everybody by listing this distinct population segment as endangered, which is a higher designation. It's the highest designation for a plant or animal for protection by the federal government.
Yeah.
So all of that is to say that the Southern resident population is very, very unique and distinct, and that's what they've been classified as, is a distinct population under the taxonomic classification Ursinus orca, because we only have one taxonomic classification for all killer whales around the world, although that is definitely going to change because we know so much more about different distinct populations.
Right. And especially now that genetic information is coming out, that information is becoming probably much more accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So it's, so whereas historically you maybe had to depend on these external characteristics, mm-hmm. the shape of the fin, mm-hmm. the markings on the back. Now you've got the genetic information. You're also getting, are there differences in the language of the different populations as well?
There are differences definitely between, say, the northern residents and the southern residents.
Mm-hmm.
There are very, very different dialogues or dialects between, say, transients and residents. Generally speaking, what I'm saying, transients are mammal eaters. They are not vocal in the way that fish eating killer whales are.
Yeah, I've heard stories about about seals or sea lions in areas when they hear certain calls, like they recognize the fact that it's not a fish eater and that it's a mammal eater, and that they'll run, that they'll try and get out of the area as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. So that there is this call and response, and there's recognition actually happening. Are those true stories? Or
I would say yes. They are probably picking up on something. Generally speaking, unless a mammal eater has recently made a kill, they don't really make noise. They've even modified their breathing above water to not exhale as nearly as loudly as, say, the fish eaters.
That just sounds underhanded, devious. Like they're just out. I mean, they are a predator. Successful. Yeah, successful predator, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Hunting strategy for sure.
Kind of scary.
Yeah, yeah. So, so a seal would, you know, if there were some reason why a mammal eating whale was making noise, then a seal would certainly hear it, whereas right. a fish wouldn't. I've seen a seal in the water when the fish eaters went by within probably 50 feet, and there wasn't really, there was kind of a, you know, a head turning and looking by the seal, but there wasn't any like, wow, I have to get out of this water in any way that I can. Whereas right. conversely, we've had, not me personally, but seals jumping on boats to get away, you know, on swim steps to get away from transients that are pursuing them.
Wow.
So they definitely know the difference.
Yeah, I found a video of some transients. Let's see if I can get the right video up here. Yeah, here it is. Get it up there. Get the right video up.
Good evening. Whale experts say it's something they've just never seen in Puget Sound until this month. Orcas attacking gray whales. That's what a group of recreational whale watchers say they captured on camera today. King 5's Owen Lay is live in Laconer tonight with the photos and video of the incident. Owen?
Alan, Orca Network tells us it's the third time this past month they've gotten a report like this. Before that, nothing. Never heard of anything happening this far inland, and this is the first time that's been captured on camera, so they're hoping that they can look at the video and find out what is causing this aggressive behavior.
Blind and then caught. There he is.
A gray whale surfaces belly up, then jerks upward. Whale experts who've seen this amateur video say it's consistent with the whale being hit from underwater. In fact, when the gray whale jolts, what appears to be a stream of urine comes out of its body. All these witnesses say the culprits were these orcas.
It was amazing how fast they were going at that point.
These amateur whale watchers watched it all unfold from the Laconer-based Mystic Sea this afternoon.
We were following a gray whale.
Just before 1 p.m. in the passage between Whidbey and Kamano Islands.
The captain said, a group of orca whales is coming up behind us, so watch out.
We could see the orcas were in a direct line toward the gray whale.
Witnesses say when they were about 100 yards apart, both orcas and the gray whale submerged. The next time they saw the gray whale was when she surfaced upside down.
The orcas popped up next to it and took off.
Then she just laid there a little bit, and then she rolled and turned back over and got on about a 10-degree angle, trying to get herself righted up totally, and was just kind of floundering, you know, in the water.
We were thinking maybe it was harder for the orca to get to the gray from the spine.
Experts say that's a likely scenario. The whale may have flipped to protect itself. It also may have been injured. And after all the orcas left,
eventually rolled back over on its stomach and swam in toward the beach. And that was it.
Orca Network tells us they did get one call from someone who spotted the whale later in shallow water, still in that same area, but acting strangely. A few minutes later, however, the gray whale disappeared, and no one's seen it since. As for the orca pod, experts were able to trail those orcas into Penn Cove, they say, where they were actually headed towards another group of gray whales. Reporting live in Laconer, Owen Lay, King 5 News.
All right. Thank you, Owen, now.
That whale lived, by the way.
Oh, did it?
The gray's name Patch.
Oh, wow. That's good to know. Because you always wonder. You're like, how did the attacked whale end up? Is it, you know?
Yeah.
You get as a person, you somehow get attached and affected to the to the outcome somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So this transient killer whale behavior of attacking gray whales, or is this common behavior? Is there something anything that you can say about studying what happened in this situation?
That's actually the first film that I've seen of it. I've been reading between other researchers in the area and other people that had witnessed it, kind of a blog sort of deal. What I would say for up there is that grays historically were more popular up there, but in the last, and I wish I had a number for you, but 10 years or 10 plus,
yeah,
probably more, they haven't been that common. So much so that when we had one in, I guess 2005, it was a really exciting, and he was there for quite a long time.
Yeah,
it was an exciting change for whale watching and whale research. When he, in fact, we named him Steady Freddy because he was always there. And so now it is interesting, and it makes me wonder what's going on. Everybody right now is talking about the seemingly decreased population of grays in California from what one mm-hmm. would expect. And then to have more and more and more grays showing up in Puget Sound in this year is interesting.
Yeah.
As far as their attack mode, that's, I think, very common. They definitely ram animals to stun them, particularly larger animals, sharks.
Yeah, because gray whales are much larger mm-hmm. than the average killer mm-hmm. whale, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not much larger, but let's say much larger than their normal prey, which would be more okay. like a harbor porpoise or a seal,
mm-hmm.
harbor seal. They do go for stellar sea lions, which can get to be huge.
Big.
So again, I'm really kind of focusing on the mammal eaters that are up in the Washington yeah. area. Worldwide mammal eaters are very, very interesting in that they differentiate their prey depending on where they are in the world. So, you know, everybody's seen on TV or movies or whatever, the Argentinian whales going, you know, beaching themselves
yeah.
to get the seal wieners, the kind of right in between adult and so that those seals that have just recently been weaned from their mothers.
Yeah.
So these whales launching themselves onto the beach, which is very dangerous, could be potentially dangerous. And to have a mother orca like helping to toss her calf up there to help teach that behavior.
Yeah.
That's an example of culture, like I was kind of hinting at before.
Yeah.
So these are feeding specializations that are unique to different parts of the world. We have whales that just really kind of preferentially go for more like skates and stingrays.
Mm-hmm.
And then some whales are much more, say, you know, I think it's, you know, it's obviously what mammal or what prey item is available.
Yeah. But all killer whales have the ability to eat whatever they want. But do you think it's going out to the cultural side mm-hmm. of it? Is it taught? Is a dietary
yes.
preference something that comes from
definitely
what their parents give them
absolutely.
When they're young and teach them?
Mm-hmm.
To, yeah,
absolutely. So the thought is with regard, see, and as a biogeographer, it's why I'm so interested in the Puget Sound area, because we have all three forms there. We
right.
have the mammal eater, we have the fish eater, and we have what are called offshores, which are their body shape, their feeding techniques. All of this is kind of unique. There's a little bit of mammal eating killer whale traits in there and a little bit of fish eating
mm-hmm.
Killer whale traits in there. We don't know a lot about offshores because they're offshore and it's very harsh environment to research in.
Yeah.
But when they come close, we try and... researchers try and take data. The area, though, does have all three forms. And so it makes one wonder, how is it that an area can support so many animals? And so the theory is that 8,000 plus years ago, they speciated to the degree that they were eating on different levels of the food chain.
Right. So there's specialization within specific habitat
exactly.
or ecosystem niches.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. So it's like, I'm going to eat fish. I'm going to leave your mammals
yep.
alone. You go eat the mammals. We're not going to come.
Right.
We won't get in each other's
right.
way.
So much so that now they don't mingle at all. You would almost think that, you know, some mating would go on. But generally speaking, the DNA is not supporting much outbreeding from... So the southern residents, J's will mate with K's and L's, and L's will mate with J's and K's, but they don't really mate with, they don't mate within their own pod,
mm-hmm.
and they don't really mate, it's not showing DNA-wise that they're really mating, at least
outside.
On a regular basis, with the mammal eaters that are in the area at the same time. So I let me just really quickly, so that yeah. we talk about this misnomer, this name thing.
Yes, please.
When people are really trying to get away from it, I find myself doing it too, saying, residents and transients.
Yeah, because it does cause a bit of confusion. Mm-hmm. You think it means, I mean, I hear resident and I think, okay, you stay there.
Right.
You know, I got to get my residency so that my college tuition is cheaper.
Exactly. So, no, it's not. It's I think that that came about because when the researchers really started determining Ken Balcom being one, Mike Bigg being another. He was a Canadian researcher. Dr. John Ford, also in Canada, when they started realizing that they could identify the individual animals based on naturally occurring, like you say, pigmentation of the saddle patch, it's called that white area behind the dorsal fin shape, the nicks and scratches, all of these things are unique to individuals and we can identify them. There are no two saddle patches that are the same. No two.
It's kind of like a fingerprint.
Exactly. Yeah. So when we started, when researchers started realizing that they could identify them, they were researching them during the summer or during those months when it was reasonable to be doing field-based research in the water.
Right.
And
good weather, whales, better weather.
Yeah. these whales were always there. And so back then, 30 years ago, the whales were more commonly there, say, of a month or by month for a given year. Mm-hmm. For example, J-pod tends to be seen at least one time every month of every year. I think there was something like maybe twice, 2 months out of the last 30 years where somebody from J-pod
didn't show
that
up.
That could be a little bit wrong, but I'm trying to like show like generally J-pod is kind of in the area.
Mm-hmm.
K-pod, we have no idea where they go during the winter. When they leave, when they're seen for the last time, usually in December, they are not really seen until they come back again in April, May, June. 1 year, 2006 or 2007, they didn't show up until July 4th.
And they haven't, nobody's done the tracking studies, put on just a long-term kind of beacon to see where they go, kind of like the turtle research.
Yeah.
Where are you going, turtle?
Right. Surprisingly, not long-term like that. There have been some shorter-term, say, critter cams deployed on southern residents where they have some actual underwater film of the whales, and that was some amazing research by Dr. Robin Baird.
Oh, another pretty book. Killer Whales of the World, Natural History and Conservation by Robin W. Baird. Nice.
Yeah, so he did his dissertation research on the mammal-eating killer whales of the region. He and his team, Dr. Brad Hansen from NOAA as well, and the folks from Cascadia Research Collective have been doing research on these whales and have done some tagging. But the tagging right now has actually been on the mammal eaters, and part of it was political because if you're tagging an endangered species, it needs to go through the proper channels so that everybody knows what's happening, when it's going to happen. We know that it's not going to harm the whales when you have a population that's so small doing anything at all that could potentially harm them. So it's taken a long time before people have been comfortable with that. So I do believe that it might happen. And nicely, the technology is getting to the point where it would make sense. You know, these beacons don't last all that long.
Yeah, so do you have to worry about battery life?
Absolutely.
And, is that the main concern?
It is.
Because I guess with killer whales, I've done bird research, and so weight is a huge concern with birds.
Yeah.
But with killer whales, you probably don't have the same weight
issue. It's not the same weight issue for sure. But then it's a question of how one attaches it. So is it, a dart that sticks in there for a while and then ends up fluffing off, or, you know, way, way, way back when these things were first being done, they were actually bolted onto the dorsal fin and that didn't last very long or go very well. So I think the technology is getting to the point where it will make sense to do these longer term surveys. But there's been surveys that have gone offshore out to the continental shelf and back, kind of doing these transects. I was fortunate to be able to go on one in 2007, and it was amazing. We didn't find southern residents. We found mammal eaters and actually amazingly northern residents off the coast of Washington. So people are looking, but it is very difficult during the winter to be out in that environment.
Yeah.
So folks on land, Ken Balcom for the last lot of years has been going up and down the coast, putting flyers up and saying, if you see killer whales, call this
number. Let us know.
Take a picture and send us the photo.
It seems like the perfect opportunity for a citizen science project.
Yes.
That, you know, if you're just out, if you see it, you know, maybe someone needs to make an iPhone app for killer whale sightings.
Yep.
So you can just hit a button and say, I saw one.
Yes.
And then it would telemetry locate or GPS locate your location and pinpoint it. That could help somebody a lot. You technology people out there, you could get on it.
Definitely.
I know there are people out there who can do it.
I heard about a friend who was wanting to, she lives down in Alki, West Seattle, where that gray whale, near where the gray whale attack was. And she wants to make an app for her phone, for people's phone, where these photos are in the phone so that you can take
so
a
you
picture
can,
and then
and
it
then
will
match it.
And then that would be amazing.
That would be really cool. So the dorsal fin and the saddle marking would be something that could be matched just by taking a picture.
Yep.
I love it.
I know. It would be very cool.
I need to take a quick break.
Sure.
A word from our sponsor. So if you'll just hang on for 1 second. I'd like to take a break to thank Audible.com for sponsoring this hour of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. Audible.com is the leading provider of audio books online that you can download to any player, to your computer, to your MP3 player, whatever way you like to listen. You can listen wherever you want to listen. You can listen to all sorts of content. They've got thousands of titles in, you know, science, which I love, science fiction, whatever you might want to name. Now, they are offering a free audiobook to those of you who visit their site and sign up for a trial. And if you visit audiblepodcast.com/Kiki, you will be able to sign up and get a free audiobook download and give it a try, see if you like it. So it's audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. Now, my audiobook pick of the week has to do with our guest on next week's show. We are going to be speaking with Rebecca Skloot, the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. And it's a story of her search for the truth of immortal lineage of HeLa cells, H-E-L-A. They're cancerous cells that nobody knew who they came from. And there were all sorts of stories about where they came from, who they came from. And eventually it was discovered they came from a woman named Henrietta Lacks. And this is the story of Rebecca's obsession with Henrietta's story, with her family and everything that occurred over a 10-year period as she researched this woman and her life. So it's a fascinating, fascinating read. If you want to take a listen to it, you can download it at audiblepodcast.com/Kiki, and you can be ready for next week's show. And you can be informed and ready to ask questions, which is what I'm going to be looking forward to. So thanks again to our sponsor, Audible.com, for sponsoring this hour. And this is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. Go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. Now, back to the show. So, Giles, we've talked a lot about like the language and some of the culture of these animals and studying them using telemetry and long distance and the challenges of being able to track them in the winter months. A lot of the populations of killer whales, aren't they mostly cold water, northern hemisphere animals? Are they pretty much all of the populations difficult to track in the winter months? Do they all tend to go to the colder areas?
I've heard it said that they are besides humans and rats, the most widely dispersed mammal on the planet.
Wow.
So they're in all oceans.
Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think I've just only heard of them, you know, Northern Pacific over, mm-hmm. you know, over Eastern or Western.
Yep. Yeah. No, they're everywhere. And certainly there are populations that are better studied.
Right.
But yeah, they're everywhere. And they, you know, they're not a lot of them, probably. That was one of my little factoids I wanted to get for the show. I was trying to research approximately how many individual killer whales do we think there are on the planet. And I cannot find the answer to that. But generally speaking, not that many. It's I don't even want to speculate how many, but given that they are everywhere as far as they're in all the oceans, mm-hmm. you would think that there would be maybe large populations of them. Generally, when you see it written, and the worldwide population of killer whales is small.
Is small. Okay, that's not helping.
Exactly. So if anybody out there knows the answer to that, I'd be interested to know that.
Well, it seems interesting also. I mean, the population number that you mentioned for the residents of 89 individuals is very small.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're looking at, you know, how many populations are there overall,
right.
and are all of them fairly small, or are they...
No, not like that.
Not at all.
And okay. That was one of the reasons why this population was listed as a distinct population and able to be given protections under mm-hmm. the Endangered Species Act. To give you an example, the northern resident killer whales, they tend to frequent the northern part of Vancouver Island and then up into the Queen Charlotte Islands.
Okay.
So quite a bit north, although their southern range does extend down into the northern part of the southern resident range.
Okay.
Again,
there's a bit of overlap.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
But they never really
interact.
Mingle.
Huh.
Their population is probably triple what the southern wow. resident is. And then...
Is there more... do you know what kind of factors are responsible for that? Is there... are we looking at water pollution, at fish availability, at mammal availability? Like, what... fewer humans the further north you go? Like, less boat activity? Like, are those factors involved?
So, yeah, you pretty much nailed what the theory is. One thing that really decimated this population, the southern resident population, like I said earlier, was the removals for the captive industry. So about 49 animals were taken out of this population
wow.
and actually put into tanks, and an additional 11 to 13 that it's, I hear accounts, but at least 11 animals yeah. not included in that 49 were killed in the process. So that's a huge number of individual animals that were taken out of the southern resident population.
And proportionally to the number of animals
exactly.
that were taken, that's a huge kill rate.
That's exactly right.
That's awful.
So it is awful. It is awful. And that's obviously why the folks that really were up in arms when this was still going on in the early 70s
yeah.
to the mid-70s, why they were saying this has to stop. We know that this is a finite population, and
mm-hmm.
all of these removals for parks were coming out of this population at that time.
It's like, hey, they're here. Let's take them. They're yeah. easy to get to. And
exactly.
Yeah.
They're predictable in that they come back mm-hmm. every summer for following the fish.
Right, which makes tracking, knowing where they're going to show up mm-hmm. and trapping them easier.
Exactly.
Wow.
So so that's a confounding factor for the southern residents. And then back to what you were saying, absolutely the waters in Puget Sound are poisoned. There's an amazing video out. I should have probably brought you a copy. It's called Poison Waters, and it's a documentary that was done fairly recently it was released within the last 12 months, and it talks about the poison waters in Puget mm-hmm. Sound and why that's such a problem for killer whales, given that they're apex predators. They're the mammal-eating killer whales in that area are thought to be some of the most toxic animals on the planet.
Wow.
You couldn't, if one washed up on shore, it would have to be disposed of in a toxic waste dump, not, say, sunk or, you know, towed out to sea.
Toxic waste dump?
Yeah.
So the flesh of these animals is
so toxic.
Full of toxins mm-hmm. from being at the top of the food chain mm-hmm. that they are toxic waste dumps themselves.
Yeah, essentially.
Hazardous waste?
Yeah. Exactly.
Wow.
Particularly the males who don't
wow.
have any way to offload their toxins like the females do when they get pregnant.
So is that something? That's an interesting point. Do the in getting pregnant and giving birth, do the females actually, when they give birth off, just push a lot of stuff out? Mm-hmm. Or is it all part of, hey, the new baby being put out there is full of toxins?
No, that's absolutely right. It's the new baby is full of toxins. And then furthermore, her milk is full of toxins.
Wow.
So
that's a great way to start your life.
Yeah. Well, more than about half of them don't make it, which is why we can't count those five that have recently been born until they make it for the first year.
Right.
So toxins are a problem, obviously.
Is death rate higher than birth rate?
We're kind of at a balance right now with the Southern residents. We lost 7 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. Well, we just gained 5. So it's kind of this teeter-totter right now. And so that's why the other factors are so important. So the lack of food, you mentioned, you know, prey availability. So with regard to the Southern residents who are fish eaters, we know that their population, they're really, you know, they eat fish and they're really picky eaters. We know from research that's being done by Cascadia Research and by NOAA right now that they are, and by John Ford in Canada, that they are really, really picky and they really, really want Chinook salmon, the fattiest of the five species of salmon up there. And Chinook are one of the most threatened
of the salmon species. Yeah.
So this last year was really interesting because it was in kind of folklore of fishermen up in the area. It was one of the largest runs of pinks that anybody had ever remembered. Pink salmon. So it will be interesting to know from some of the fecal work that's being done and the fish scale work that's being done, so the prey work, what were these Southern residents eating last year when there were so many pinks available? Were they still preferentially going for the oddball Chinook that were within the mix?
Or were they going for eating whatever happened to be there just so they could eat?
And, right.
Yeah.
Right.
It might not be as fatty, but...
Yeah, but if they were that abundant, then that might make sense. So those are two. So the toxins and the lack of prey, and then the quality of the prey, the size, and the fact that the fish are toxic too. Those are two of the kind of main, say, top three or four threats that were listed for the Southern residents as threats, you know, under the Endangered Species Act. The other one was vessels. So the presence and the noise that they make, and then also the possibility of oil spills in the area.
Somebody in our chat room, Mikey Cav, found a NOAA link, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, saying that the population estimates look to vary between 50,000 to 100,000 individuals worldwide.
See, that's huge, from 50,000 to 100,000.
The variance in that is like, we're almost there.
Yeah.
So is it a half mile away or a mile away? Is it? Yeah.
So, but thank you for that. At least
it's an estimate. It's a number. Mm-hmm. And it's not a big number. When you think of how large the oceans are, how big the planet is, how much potential room there could be there, and the populations probably used to be much larger than they are currently. Mm-hmm. I would imagine there's been a significant drop.
Mm-hmm. There, yeah.
Do you know news, not necessarily for killer whales, but for other species of whales, it's sonar activities have been suggested and possibly shown to affect whale species and affected beachings of whales. Mm-hmm. Is this something that you think affects? I mean, this could be part of the boat noise, the vessel noise in Puget Sound, but is this something that's...
It is a problem. It has been a problem in the past, more so. What happened, it was an amazing episode. I don't know what else to call it. The Navy was doing fairly extensive sonar testing in Puget Sound. And I apologize, I don't have the exact year. It was, I'm guessing, maybe 8 years ago or so. There was a, it's, again, somebody could Google this. It's the Shoop was the name of the vessel. And Ken Balcom, who's
the book
Center for Whale Research, he's the one that does the catalog for who's who and who's there. He does the census, the yearly census. His house, his center is right on Haro Strait, right on this, on the kind of the main thoroughfare for where the whales hang out during the summer foraging. And he has amazing video of a whole group of whales. As the Shoup was deploying this sound, the whales came up to the surface of the water, had their heads and their chins out of the water. They received noise into the fatty layer in their chin. Yeah. So the whales' heads were out of the water and they were swimming as fast as they could towards shore as this sound was in the water.
Wow.
And because Ken was there and got the film at that time, the Navy has, it's been kind of back and forth and back and forth. But as it stands right now, the Navy isn't really doing testing in Puget Sound, certainly not when,
not when
it's
the whales
known that
there.
The whales are there.
Yeah.
And that's huge. So yes, they do, the sonar does impact whales. Not so the what you were talking about with the larger, deeper diving whales is they have, you know, they're those poor whales, and the beaked whales are having just a tremendous time with that. It's a very, very sad situation. What's ending up happening is that not only the beachings, but what's possibly causing that is inner ear ruptures. And then also they're getting the bends from coming up too fast the surface of the water. So they're, you know, they're full of
because they're mammals the same as we are. If they are underwater at depth, and it doesn't, you don't have to be that deep to get it's which hydrogen comes out of the blood and turns into actual air bubbles inside your veins and causes pain, incredible pain. And if you don't, divers have to go through decompression. If they, and if they don't, then it can have serious repercussions. Yeah. And so for the same situation for a whale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's terrible. It is a problem. And there are some things that the Navy's doing to try and
Nitrogen. Yeah. I know. I was like, ah.
Good, thanks.
I got it wrong.
And my brain was going, they are trying to have observers on board, thankfully, where before they do any of their testing, they're at least having observers out there trying to be aware of cetaceans or, you know, not just cetaceans, but whales in the area before these maneuvers happen. And so I think that that will help worldwide and in smaller areas if people can get a film like Ken Balcom did where it's an obvious effect of this. You know, the whales are absolutely changing their behavior because of the sonar. That's the best we can do for local protections. So anyhow, I wanted to just really quickly get back to the transient and resident thing. So I said K-pod, not known where they go during the winter. One small group of L-pod, so we've got J's, K's, and L's up in Puget Sound where I research. One small group of L-pod has been known to frequent the waters in Monterey. So over the last couple of years, they have been seen down there more and more regularly, almost kind of like every year. Although this year, I have not heard any reports. Last year, January, there was amazing sightings of this group of L-pod. So when we say resident, they're actually transient mammal-eating killer whales that are in the Puget Sound area way more often than most members of the, quote, resident southern resident killer whales. So it's funny, but I think
so some terminology might need to change naming standards.
Exactly.
Yeah, maybe there's a better, more accurate way to define them as opposed to their resident or transient status.
Because I think it is interesting, particularly for, say, engendering interest in whales of a place, if it is kind of felt that they are resident. And so do you know what I mean? Like there are whales, mammal-eating killer whales that are there all the time, and people know those whales just like they know the residents that come in the summer. And I think if people start thinking about them as individuals and not just as this thing in the environment that shows up or doesn't show up, it's going to be better for helping to protect them, the whales, and their environment, and help, hopefully, encourage people to start making some changes in our lives that will ultimately benefit the natural environment. So curbing toxins into the water and, you know, possibly removing critical dams so that spawning fish can get back up there where they need to be.
Right, which could... It would be good for the whales. It would probably also be good for us as well. If we reduce the amount of toxins that are going into the water, that's only going to reflect well into our future.
Right.
Because we eat fish as well. We're top predators.
Right. Right.
And I'm a nice little toxic waste dump.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, even if you we're toxic waste dumps.
Yeah.
And then if you do, it just compounds that problem. And so... Absolutely. I think so by saying that we've got resident mammal eaters, I think is a good thing. And people are really starting to pay a lot of attention. There's a really great organization. They're called Orca Network. And they...
Orcas in our midst.
I'm pinching everybody.
all this paperwork and books and pamphlets. I love it.
Orca Network does a great job. You were talking about citizen science, and these folks are in the business of collecting that information when people have sightings and video or photographs or just stories about what they've seen of a day. Orca Network puts out, it's usually daily, but if there's computer problems on their island or they're vacationing or something, it might not be every day. But generally speaking, it's every day where you can get updates on what's happening, particularly with the southern residents, but also the mammal eating residents.
Right.
I think I'm going to try and get that in
the mammal eating residents. That would be good.
The transient residents.
Yeah.
They do just a really great job of keeping everybody aware of what's going on with regard to new science that's coming out, with regard to new babies that are born, individuals that haven't been seen. So, hey, everybody, keep your eye out for L57. Yeah. We haven't seen him. Things like that. Those sorts of networking tools, I think, are fantastic.
What was that group called again?
They're called Orca Network. And they are actually really kind of maybe bridging this question about the captives. Orca Network has been very, very vocal and very active for 30 years since one of the, there's still a southern resident killer whale that's in captivity. They call her Lolita. She's in Florida. Her name's Tucate, as far as those of us up in the islands and who know these animals. She's a member of LPOD, and her family is still free swimming, free living in the wild. And Orca Network has been really, really active in trying to bring awareness to the fact that this LPOD whale is still in captivity. And also they do a fair amount of work for a whale named Corky, who's in San Diego. And she, too, has been in captivity. She's been in captivity slightly longer. Did I say 30 years? I mean 40 years.
40 years.
40 years. 1969 and 1970, those two whales.
You bring up, so this gets back to the beginning of the show, the idea of keeping these animals in captivity. And how... I'm just trying to think of how hard is it to get these animals into a state where they would be ready to be released back out of captivity. Can we release captive whales back into the wild? Is that possible? And, you know, should we start trying to make a movement, you know, as a society to ask for the killer whales release from captivity?
Well, I think that of the, 49 animals that are in captivity right now, there are certainly candidates that, individual whales that would make better candidates than other individual whales. The two that I just mentioned would make great candidates even if you just looked at it from a scientific perspective, what on earth could we learn? Talk about being able to really study an animal. Yeah. This would be an amazing opportunity. The reason that I say that these two in particular would be very, very good candidates is because their families are still alive. We still know who their family is. Hmm. They still speak their native their natal language.
Wow.
They were taken out. They were both removed from the wild when they were old enough to forage on their own. Whereas some of these younger ones, Tillicum, one of them, he was really young when he was taken out. He was probably foraging on his own, but, you know, he was three. And those three-year-olds are like glue to their mom's side in the wild. Unless they're with another really close relative where they're off playing or something, these animals are extremely socially bonded with their family. And given that we know who Corky and Lolita's families are and that they're still living and that they were old enough to be able to forage on their own and that they still speak their native language, I just really feel that these two animals would make excellent candidates.
Yeah.
And what it would take to release them is a lot. It would be an endeavor, but I think that the way that I would envision it is, you know, this facility where Keiko was taken in Newport, Oregon, is a great facility. That facility could be used to rehab these animals, either together, but probably preferentially not together.
Yeah.
Given that they're from two different clans. But just do it in a slow way. You would have to reintroduce live food to them. They don't get to
eat. They haven't hunted for their own food for 40 years.
Wow.
Yeah. It would be all of a sudden you go, how do I use a shopping cart in the grocery store?
Yeah, I know. Keiko learned, though. Keiko learned how to forage for himself, and he gained 2,000 pounds and 8 inches in his rehabilitation time in Oregon. I believe the reason that Keiko was not a successful candidate for release is because his family had been killed. There was no one else.
There was
nobody that was speaking his language still where he was. And he had some time up there, and he definitely lived the life of a wild whale. He was largely alone, though, and he's a social animal. He was from a fish-eating group, so his family would have been extremely tightly bonded as well. Yeah. So I feel that, Corky many, many years ago was played an audio recording of her mother, and her whole body started to shake. She went into, like, not convulsions.
Almost a seizure.
Yeah. Upon hearing her mother's voice. And there were people that really pushed for a live
goosebumps.
Link. I know. That's the first time I've actually been able to say it without crying.
Wow.
In my, you know, whatever years, 20 plus years of knowing that. That is, to me, a really good reason to seriously think about that animal, those two animals, and potentially other ones. There are other animals that were captured from the wild that might make good candidates. The ones that aren't going to make good candidates are when these facilities are breeding fish eaters to mammal eaters, or fish eaters from one, you know, completely different part of the world to another one. There's, you know,
indiscriminately putting them together. Mm-hmm. And so those individuals won't have any association in the real world.
Right. Right.
Outside of captivity, they would have
particularly second generation captive bred, which we have now. We have grand.
They've never had any experience outside of the tanks.
No.
Wow.
Not only that, but neither had their mother. So maybe their grandmother was from the wild, but they're, you know, that it's
getting interesting.
It's yeah. So those ones, you know, potentially could be moved to more natural facilities, say with actual ocean water instead of saline chlorine combo water that they get in captivity. And then, you know, essentially turn it into something where research can still be done on them.
Yeah.
They are given the enrichments that they need to be healthy individuals.
Yeah.
The paying public could come and pay. It would just be more of a nonprofit sort of situation.
And maybe they would just have to be happy with seeing whales in a similar to natural habitat environment and not doing tricks for them. Maybe people should get to know that that's okay. I don't know.
And no more captive breeding. I mean, I think that that's critical, and we're not there yet. You know, Tillicum is absolutely still being used. He's one of...
I heard that he's worth millions of dollars because
he's
a sire. He is siring many offspring.
Well, for a while, he was the only the only male in captivity that was that had viable sperm. So he was the only male that was the father for over 13 animals, I think.
Wow.
And so, yeah, talk about, you know, somebody better be keeping track of that.
Yeah. Speaking of keeping track, we are at the end of our hour.
Holy cow, that went fast.
I know. This has been so interesting and so much fun. It's been wonderful speaking with you.
Thank you, you too.
So much great information. And it's good to try and, I think, clarify ideas about what killer whales are, who they are, what we're learning about them, and what is still, what we still don't know. And what there's so much yet to learn, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I would like to say that if anybody is interested in the research that Deborah Giles is doing, you can visit the Biotelemetry Laboratory. You can check it out online at biotelemetry.ucdavis.edu, and they have a number of species that they are following, and there are a number of experts. This page that I'm showing here is specifically focused on the orcas, and this is the project that Deborah Giles is leading. Pete Klimley, doesn't he work on hammerhead sharks?
He does. Dr. Hammerhead.
Dr. Hammerhead, that's right. Anyway, so that is one resource for you to check out if you have any questions. And if you are looking for finding out more information, maybe you can head to the Biotelemetry Laboratory to find out what you need to know. Or maybe it's a good place to start as a resource. I'm Dr. Kiki, and this has been Dr. Kiki Science Hour. And next week, as I said earlier in the show, we're going to be talking about Henrietta Lacks, the immortal cells of, with Rebecca Skloot. So I'm very excited about that. Until then, you can follow my sciencey pursuits on Twitter at Dr. Kiki, at drkiki.tv for my website, or you can find my Facebook fan page, which is under Dr. Kiki. It's all very straightforward. You can subscribe to the Science Hour in iTunes, and you can find past episodes at twit.tv/Kiki. Also, if you need even more sciencey goodness, you can listen to This Week in Science, which is now on the Twit Network at 8 p.m. on Monday nights, Pacific time. And that can also be found at twist.org. So I will see you next week. Thanks for tuning into my Science Hour. All I ask is 1 hour a week. And in return, your world gets a lot more interesting.